The unofficial end to summer is here. School has started for most, football season is upon us, and soon, the leaves will be changing color. At the DSR Network, we remain as busy as ever, with a full slate of podcasts scheduled for the fall. In the coming weeks, we'll be launching two new shows with new hosts, creating even more content for our members. Members receive an ad-free listening experience, an evening newsletter, an invitation to join the DSR Slack community, bonus content, and more. Best of all, if you become a member in the month of September, you'll receive 20% off the normal membership price. Visit thedsrnetwork.com/buy and enter code SCHOOL at checkout. That's thedsrnetwork.com/buy and code SCHOOL. Thank you for your support.
Nine, 12, 10, 28, 2, 23.
This is Deep State Radio, coming to you direct from our super secret studio in the third sub-basement of the Ministry of Snark in Washington, D.C., and from other undisclosed locations across America and around the world.
Hello and welcome to the podcast. It's that time of the week for us to be talking a little bit about the state of politics in the United States. And I am delighted to be joined today by our friend Mike Tomasky, who is not alone. He's with his dog. You can hear that. But Mike is the editor of The New Republic, also of Democracy. He is an author. He is a commentator. And he's a dog breeder. What breed of dog is that there with you, Mike?
He is a combination Great Pyrenees and Golden. And there's a guy outside fixing the screen door, and it's a little more excitement than he can bear. I apologize.
Well, that's really interesting, and I want to make sure that our readers know that my dog is also a combination of Great Pyrenees and Retriever, and he behaves exactly the same way. He is very protective when he's not trying to get fed, which is his other main priority. There are a million things I want to talk to you about. You know more about more stuff than most people that I get to talk to. But both you and I, prior to this, were watching today, the day we're recording this is the Wednesday, the House Judiciary Committee. And it did a hearing with Merrick Garland, and it was surreal. It was Fellini-esque, you know, because the Democrats were behaving as though this were the Congress of the United States, and they were asking questions like, you know, what do you think of this issue, and will you respond to this, and so forth. And the Republicans were complete nutcase assholes. All they wanted to talk about was Hunter Biden. They just don't seem to care about governing, about the law. And Jim Jordan chairs this committee, who is one of the sort of, you know, at the bottom of the bottom feeders in this House. But, you know, maybe that's not your perspective. Maybe you loved it, and maybe you thought the Republicans were doing a great job.
Each one has been loonier than the one before him, and I've just been sitting here with my mouth agape watching this. Yeah, Hunter Biden, but there were other things too. The border, this 4,000% increase in fentanyl, which is a lie, some of them talked about. And then, you know, and the thing they do, David, is, as you know, they ask these straw man questions that try to obfuscate the issue that they're talking about. So this guy from Alabama, I can't remember his name, said, "Now let me ask you, Mr. Attorney General, is it illegal in this country for someone to question an election outcome? Is that illegal?" But, you know, of course it's not illegal. Anybody can question anything, you know. But that's not what Donald Trump did, you know. I mean, Garland's answer was dissatisfying, and I know you have to suck up to these people, as crazy as they are, but I wish he'd just said something like, "Well, you know, anybody can question anything, but there are citizens, grand juries comprised of citizens of this country that decided he did a lot more than question and they decided that, you know, there was evidence that he committed crimes. That goes way beyond questioning, idiot. I wish he'd been able to say that.
I wish he would. Although you got to admit, Merrick Garland, whatever you may think of the pace with which he does things, he has patience, he has dignity, he has very clear principles, and he withstands these, you know, sort of malevolent children better than, you know, I couldn't. I would have lost it at some point in the middle of this. But he handled it with a lot of grace.
Well, he did. And, you know, I mean, I know there's been a lot of complaining about him on our side, and I've done some of it. And, you know, but, you know, I think on balance, history's going to decide that Biden's instinct and Garland's instinct that the need to reestablish the independence of the Justice Department was preeminent after Donald Trump and Bill Barr, who has now become, God bless him for it, I guess, a major Trump critic. But he sure wasn't when he was the Attorney General. He was anything but that. So for Garland to say, I'm not the president's lawyer, we need that. History needs that. And, you know, reality, those of us in the reality-based world know that, you know, he's gone maybe too far in the other direction, you know, giving David Weiss in Delaware, you know, this authority to launch a special prosecution into Hunter Biden, you know, and indict him over a gun charge, over a gun that he owned for 11 days before he went back and sold it again.
Yeah, no, absolutely crazy. The Hunter Biden thing is crazy. And some of the things they do are more damaging than other things. You know, the threat to, you know, defund the FBI would be disastrous, obviously. Another thing, though, that is looming out there, that if not disastrous, is certainly going to prove to be problematic, is it seems very likely that the Republicans in the House are going to push us into a government shutdown in just a matter of days. And I was talking to a congressman last night, and he said, oh, no, that's going to happen. He said, you know, the reality is that McCarthy is under the thumb of the Marjorie Taylor Greens and so forth, and he's gonna have to, you know, he doesn't have the votes to get anything through without the Democrats, and there's no reason for the Democrats to, you know, save his hide. What's your take on all this?
Everybody I talk to says the same thing. It looks pretty bleak. McCarthy has no control over these people. And, you know, they can't even pass these procedural votes that failed on Tuesday. And it's just, it looks very bad. And it looks like Kevin McCarthy, his days might be numbered as Speaker, which would be an amazing thing. And
but then what happens?
Yeah, I don't know. That's a good question. Then, I mean, it's not like they're going to put anybody in there who has magic pixie dust that Kevin McCarthy lacks. You know, the exact same problems are going to exist. And I wonder if the crazy caucus, you know, has something up their sleeve that, you know, as we all know, the Speaker of the House doesn't have to be a member of the House. You know, I just wonder if they have something weird up their sleeve along those lines. Of course, the person still has to get 218 votes. And I don't think they can.
Well, the Republicans have their majority is getting slimmer by the day. The crazies don't have enough votes to do the really crazy stuff. The rest of the Republicans, who are just the spineless Republicans, don't have enough votes to get things done. Where does this leave us? Prolonged government shutdown, nothing getting done, lots of shenanigans about the speakership. You know, maybe the only thing the government's doing is trying to impeach Joe Biden for nothing. I mean, is that what our fall looks like?
Yeah, that's pretty much what it looks like. And and it's bad, not, you know, it's bad for the country because, you know, if the government shuts down, that affects real people. You know, it's not just a political game. We tend to talk about these things about, you know, which side has the advantage. And, you know, that's a legitimate topic of conversation, and we should talk about it. But we should also remember that, like, when the government shuts down, certain benefits that people need don't arrive, certain things, the offices that people need to appeal to aren't open, things that need to be happening in terms of, just getting some of this infrastructure work processed or cleaning air, around the country, all the things that government agencies do don't get done. And people don't notice that in front of their eyes necessarily, but it affects us. It affects the country. And, it affects the economy, trillions of dollars of economic, maybe not trillions, but billions of dollars of economic activity are lost, depending on how long it goes. But these guys don't care anything about that. They don't care. They don't care about these outcomes.
If you're like me, you're probably more than a bit frustrated with the state of our political system today. So why does American democracy look the way it does, and how can we make it more responsive to the people it was formed to serve? Democracy Decoded, a podcast by Campaign Legal Center, examines our government and discusses innovative ideas that could lead to a stronger, more transparent, accountable, and inclusive democracy. Host Simone Leeper speaks with experts from across the political spectrum and takes a deep dive into the forces fueling our elections, not just in our nation's capital, but at all levels of government. Democracy Decoded will help you make sense of how we currently elect our leaders and hold them accountable, and how we can better ensure that all citizens have the right to have their voices heard. Clearly, these are exactly the issues we need to be discussing right now, given what is happening all around us. Tune in to learn more about how we can use innovative ideas to build a stronger, more transparent, accountable, and inclusive democracy. Listen at democracydecoded.org or wherever you listen to podcasts.
The Republican Party, among its many defects at the moment, one of them is that it ceased to actually be a real party, seems to have braced in a kind of nihilism. It's like, well, we're all going to die, so it doesn't matter if we do anything now. It's like, sure, let's have a maniac, rapist, criminal be president. Let's, run roughshod over the Constitution, and let's gut democracy, and let's, not do anything that resembles, what we're sworn in to do in the Congress, and let's have a corrupt Supreme Court. And there are days I wake up and I'm like, how did we get here? This is, there's always been divisions on Capitol Hill. There have always been jerks on Capitol Hill. But somehow we have institutionalized, jerkiness into a kind of movement in the United States. It's hard to explain simply by saying, well, we have too much inequality, or these people have a lot of grievances, or Twitter is to blame. How do you rationalize it, or do you just talk to your dog and go on long walks?
I think that the guy's driving away, so I think the dog is going to settle down here in a minute. But David, there are so many threads here. The things you mentioned are part of it, but long time ago. Back in the Bush years or the Clinton years, probably, the Republican Party realized that the more dysfunctional Washington and the government looks, the better it is for them and the more it hurts Democrats, because the Democrats are the party of government. The Democrats are the party that wants to take the government and make it do something, be a force for good in people's lives. And the Republicans aren't that party. The Republicans are the party that is against that. So if Washington looks dysfunctional and it looks like the government is failing, it helps them. Now, that is not the case when they shut the government down, because they pay a price for that. But in general, normal dysfunction, it looks bad. It makes the Democratic Party look bad. So they've known that for a long time. So that's number one. But then in the Trump era, it's gotten much worse than that, because in the Trump era, you add to that the fact that they don't care about democratic norms and institutions and practices and laws anymore. All they care about is power, and anything that interferes with their power is illegitimate. That's fascist thinking. And, you know, I don't use that word lightly. I've given it a lot of thought over the years, but they are a neo-fascist party now in which, you know, the will to power is the thing that really matters. And the other party is not an entity to be negotiated with or compromised with. They're just an object to be trampled. Any lie justifies their ability to do that. So that's really where we are. And
it seems kind of like, you know, the mission of the coup, which was to impede government proceedings, continues. That's what they, you know, seek to do every day, whether it takes a riot or they can do it, you know, with their street clothes, or Jim Jordan can do it without a jacket. But they, although they do seem very head up about John Fetterman's clothes. I did.
Yes, they
You know, I mean, that's the end of the Republic. You know, exactly. Coups and criminal presidents aren't, but Fetterman and Schwartz is going to destroy America.
Right, right.
Well, let me ask you a question. You guys had a story not too long ago, which, if I recall correctly, was the title was something like, "We have two medias in this country and they're going to elect Donald Trump." And I think the media does end up playing a big role in this, because as loony as the Republicans get, the media is still, so many people in the media are still trying to say, well, Representative so-and-so said such and such, and this is his position, and blah, 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 as if they were actually behaving like members of Congress. You know, the media normalizes it all the time. What was the thrust of the story for everybody who's listening, and what do you think is the key takeaway?
Yeah, well, I wrote it, and it got a lot of traffic and a lot of attention and a lot of praise and, of course, a lot of criticism from the expected quarters. So it got people talking. Yeah, there are two medias in this country. There's the mainstream media, the New York Times, the Washington Post, et cetera. And then there's the right-wing media, Fox and One America and Newsmax and all talk radio and all the local Sinclair stations and stuff like that. And I, first of all, I go through it historically and I say, you know, for many years, the mainstream media, there were these two medias, but the mainstream media was much larger and the mainstream media was the agenda-setting media. And the right-wing media existed, but in the 80s and 90s, it was this little thing off to the side. Now, I think we have to come to grips with the fact that that's completely changed. They're about the same size, or maybe the right-wing media is even a little bit bigger. But the point is that over the last few years, the right-wing media has taken over from the mainstream media as having more power to set the agenda. They're more agenda setting because they speak with one party line voice, in, you know, support of Republicans, in support of right wing causes, and they'll never, ever, ever say anything good about Joe Biden or any Democrat, unless it's like Joe Manchin. So because they speak with that one voice, they have the power to set the agenda. They set the agenda, and the mainstream media now reacts to the agenda they set. And so the mainstream media, whether complicitly or not, whether consciously or not, really is not, they're not supporting democratic values in the way they should. And by that, I mean, of course, small d democratic values. They shouldn't be on the side of the Democratic Party. They should, you know, an objective news organization should try its best to be an objective news organization. But they do need to be on the side of democracy and truth. And I have a sentence in there that is just one simple lesson. When fairness and truth are at odds, journalism must choose the truth, even if it looks, quote unquote, unfair to the Republicans or the right wing. They got to choose the truth. If we don't choose the truth, we are complicit in the demise of democracy and indeed in the demise of a free press.
Yeah, no question about that. It's a hobby horse I've been on for a long, long time now. And, but you know, both sidesing things or trying to be balanced and fair is misunderstanding the role of the media. But it doesn't explain everything. So it doesn't explain you know, why the American people don't realize that the economy is doing better.
Yeah.
Or outperforming the world. Or does it? It's because the Republicans say, oh, no, the price of eggs is high. And therefore, the media, you know, both sides of what? Why can't Americans, you know, sort of stipulate that Biden's done a lot of good for the economy? I mean, it seems so clear.
Well, I think on the question of the economy, I think it goes like this. Fox and the right-wing media say nothing good about the economy under Biden, right? They highlight everything that's bad, and the good things they explain away, you know, Trump really did that, or, you know, this is the Fed did it. But Biden gets no credit for anything. And meanwhile, look at the price of eggs, look at the price of gas, look at this, look at the every bad indicator they can highlight, they highlight. And then by contrast, the mainstream media doesn't speak in equal defense of Biden as the right-wing media speaks in critical terms. You know, in other words, to the anti-Biden chorus that emanates from the right-wing media, there is no equivalent pro-Biden chorus in the mainstream media, because the mainstream media seeks balance. And they say, well, these numbers are good and these numbers are bad. And then, of course, the business press is always pretty negative anyway, unless things are really coming up roses on every front. So you have two stories being told in sum about the economy. One is extremely anti-Biden. One is pro-Biden, but mixed and judicious. And the other one is just full-throated. And so when people hear those two stories, what are they going to believe? They're going to believe that it's not very good. And you know, I think if the right-wing media didn't exist with the power it exists, Biden's approval ratings would be 7-8 points higher.
Today's episode is brought to you by our friends at the Global Dispatches podcast. Global Dispatches is the longest-running independent world news podcast. It's hosted by veteran international affairs journalist Mark Leon Goldberg, who conducts thoughtful interviews with policymakers, think tankers, journalists, and experts of all stripes from around the world. The Guardian calls it, quote, a podcast to make you smarter, end quote. We agree. Global Dispatches cover issues ranging from conflicts and crises in Africa and the Middle East to long-term trends in international relations and the latest geopolitical intrigues at the UN and beyond. If you like Deep State Radio, and we certainly hope you like Deep State Radio, you will certainly appreciate Global Dispatches. You can find a link to Global Dispatches in the show notes of this episode, or find Global Dispatches World News That Matters on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you listen to podcasts.
Well, let's take another issue. Apparently, and you may not be aware of this, but you know, as we age, we perhaps see some benefit. If you're 77 years old, obese, and out of your mind 30% of the time or more, you're healthy.
Right.
But if you're 81 years old, ride a bicycle everywhere, are extremely fit and limber, you're not.
Right.
So somewhere around 79, we go to shit. What I mean, like that, the way the media is covering it, you know, it seems like the only place there's an age issue is Joe Biden. And the stories always begin among Democrats. There are loud whispers about whether Joe Biden should run.
Yeah.
I mean, what's up with that?
Well, it's largely the same thing, you know. I mean, if there were a left wing version of Fox News that was reporting every day on Donald Trump's lack of exercise and his horrible diet, the reality that or the perception that the public has might well be different, but there isn't any such thing. You know, MSNBC doesn't do that. I watch MSNBC a lot of the time. Nobody ever talks about Donald Trump's exercise habits or dietary regime. That's the kind of propaganda thing that Fox does that other news organizations don't. They just find a weakness. They find an Achilles heel and they poke at it and poke at it and poke at it and poke at it. Now, there's some reality to this, you know, like, And I'll grant this, you know, my mother lived to be 86, and at 75, she was playing tennis every day. And at 80, she wasn't playing tennis anymore. So I think a lot of us have seen our parents age in ways that are reflected in what people see when they see Biden on TV. But on the other hand, as you say, like, you just look at the two of them and, you know, ask people, you know, X out their faces and just present their bodies to people and say, which one of these is a heart attack candidate, is pretty clear. It ain't Biden.
Yeah, no question about it. And that's what the New Republic needs. It needs the Donald Trump health report. I think some major news organization just hired a Taylor Swift reporter, and I see no reason why you shouldn't follow suit. But now, let me take another element of this, because this story by you, and I really recommend that everybody goes out and reads it, I thought was really good, really provocative, and exactly on target. But here's another one where it's a little bit more subtle. There are polls coming out all the time, and the polls say, well, things are even. But some of the polls have big sampling errors, and none of the polls reflect recent overperformance of Democrats in all the interim elections that have taken place, including one that took place in New Hampshire this week. I mean, Democrats are outperforming past performance since the Dobbs decision by something like 10%. But the polls don't reflect it. So they're wrong. And we know they're wrong, but we keep reporting them as though it's newsworthy that a poll that's wrong with the wrong sample and the wrong model says these people are tied, when in fact, all evidence of actual voting in the past year and a half suggests no, they're not. I mean, they're wrong.
Yeah, I think the polls in Wisconsin were closer in that court election than the results ended up being. The results ended up being double digits, and right. And the polls weren't pointing in
same
that
direction. Same in Kansas.
Yeah.
Same. I mean, this district in New Hampshire yesterday was won by Trump twice, mm-hmm. and the Democrat won it by double digits. Yesterday.
Yeah. Same
in Pittsburgh. This Dobbs thing is really under the skin of a lot of people.
It really is. But again, you know, like the media, part of this too, David, really is, I must say, is the fault of the Democrats for not, you know, messaging as well as they could on a lot of these kinds of things. You know, the press will report what people say, and Republicans are just more disciplined at saying the same thing over and over and over again, and the Democrats less so. So the Democrats have to get better at that. That much I'll grant. Having said,
we also need more Democrats in the diners in Ohio that the New York Times reports about.
Yeah, right, exactly. Well, I mean, that's another thing. You know, I mean, they send people out to do these endless stories about what do Trump voters really think and what are they mad about and what do the, you know, let's go explore what's going on in the minds of these people who won't get vaccines. But, you know, they won't go out and do, did anybody send any people out to interview Biden voters in the heartland in 2020? I don't recall seeing very many of those stories.
No. And, you know, here's a hot news flash. Biden is actually from the heartland.
Yes.
And Trump is not.
Right.
You know, Trump grew up in a, you know, lived his life in a penthouse, and Biden is as blue collar as it gets. You know, I mean, now there's, you know, I mean, there's an interesting thing now, and I'd like your view on this too, because you're closer to the kind of folks who are involved. We now have an auto strike going on. Now, Joe Biden has been clearly the most pro-union president since I don't know, Roosevelt. I mean, in a long time, it was very unfashionable to be pro-union the way he is. And you know, I this could color things, particularly if it goes on for a while. What do you see as the political significance of this strike and where Biden has staked out his position.
Well, you know, I think it's great that he said what he said last Friday, that, that you know, corporations are making record profits, so they should do a record amount of sharing of those profits with their workers. So, you know, I think that's great, and it should be doing him good. You know, he is the president. If there's a prolonged shutdown, and it hurts the economy, he's going to get some blame for it. There's no way around that. And Trump will insert himself in this and will say anything without regard to whether it's true or not. You know, there is one thorny thing going on in the auto industry, which is whether the new cars or the batteries, and the new battery-driven engines are going to be union jobs, and that's something that you know I hope can be worked out. But you know, I mean, again, Trump just says anything, and the right-wing media repeats it and repeats it and repeats it, and then the mainstream media picks it up too and comes to the Democrats and says, "What do you have to say about this?" And it's always ends up being the same thing, David. It's like Trump says a lie, right-wing media repeats lie, mainstream media goes to Democrats and say, how do you respond to this lie? And you can't just say, well, it's a lie, because that doesn't persuade people.
Yeah, it's true. Although, you know, I think there's also a sort of a generational disconnect here. And it's interesting because Biden is certainly from one generation. But I've been reading a lot that sort of Gen Z voters are much more sympathetic to unions than sort of boomers and millennials, Gen X voters. And I think there's a lot of evidence to suggest that that's the case, because they realize that a lot of exploitation is going on and you need some kind of organized approach to countering it. And unions provide that. So it could be, you know, I mean, the interesting thing about Biden is, and I, you know, when he was running, I was like, this guy's too old and he's too cautious and he's not going to do anything. But it's turned out that there have been several revolutionary aspects to his presidency. Among those is this re-emphasis on the working class, blue collar America, heartland America, that flies in the face of a lot of the message of the GOP, and cuts right to, I think, places where they have a lot of strength. Shouldn't that be working for him?
Well, it should be, and you know, there's time. It may be. I mean, you know, if inflation is really tamed by next year, and there is no recession, I think people will be feeling a lot better. I mean, we already see that when people are asked about their own circumstances, they give a pretty positive answer overall. It's just when people are asked about the economy, they give a negative answer. And I think that's largely because of the media environment and the way the media talks about the economy. But, you know, it's an uphill battle, though, because Democrats, you know, Fox has convinced a pretty big chunk of the country that Democrats are against them and out to get them and don't have their values. They couldn't do that to Biden in 2020 the way they could have done it to Sanders or some of the other candidates, you know, because Biden is from a working class town. He does have that kind of blue collar credential, and he's never been out there on the cultural left, so they couldn't tag him with all that stuff. And, you know, will they succeed in doing it this time? I don't know. I don't think so. And if you ask me today, you know, if you forced me to bet today, I'd say Biden will win the election. But, you know, it's just there are far too many scenarios that show Trump winning that dance around in my brain and really scare me.
Yeah, no doubt. And no doubt it's likely to be closer than we want, particularly given our problematic electoral college. Let me ask you one last question consistent with the questions I've been asking here about your article, which, by the way, is called "We Have Two Medias in This Country and They're Going to Elect Donald Trump." But just maybe you could offer some advice to your colleagues in the media. There was an interview with Donald Trump It was on tape, so they could have done a bunch of things with it. But essentially, this was with Kristen Welker, the new host of Meet the Press. And Trump lied and lied and lied and lied and lied and lied. And the way NBC handled it was, you know, they put up a blog after the fact saying some of these things were lies. But if you put a microphone in front of Donald Trump, he's going to lie. And, you know, it would seem to me that the way you handle that is you fact check him in real time. And either the host does it or you make sure the thing's on tape and you don't release it until you've fact checked every element of it. But, you know, maybe I'm a, you know, I have Trump derangement syndrome and that's crazy. What do you think? How should this be handled? Or should we just take him as he is?
I don't know. I mean, I wouldn't give him a live interview like CNN did. That was a disaster. And I think, has it ever been established that they cut that off 20 minutes early? I mean, it sure seemed like they did to me because it was supposed to last until 9:30 and it lasted until 9:08. And Jake Tapper came in and said, okay, folks, we've seen enough, or something like that. Anyway, I wouldn't give him a live interview. And I guess the Welker one wasn't live. But, you know, what I would do is I'd stop it every however many seconds it took and said, okay, that was not a true statement. Here are the facts behind what he said. Okay, that was not a true statement. Here are the facts behind it. That's the only way to do it because, you know, he's just going to try to steamroll a Welker. And I think it was a mistake for her to do that on her first week. I mean, yeah, okay, that's a big get. You're going to get ratings. And I guess it all comes down to ratings and eyeballs. But for God's sakes, it's a very, you know, it's exactly the kind of, let's go up to 30,000 feet here as we end, David. It's exactly the kind of decision that if he wins and if there is some kind of crackdown on the free press, which there will be, and the press is sitting around second guessing itself, how were we complicit in our own demise? How were we complicit in the weakening of our First Amendment and our democracy and our traditions of which we are rightfully proud? How did we help make this happen? How did we facilitate it? And doing things like that is part of the answer. And not choosing the truth over fairness is another big part of the answer. We can't be in a position in January 2025 or 2026, a year into Trump's presidency, when, you know, I don't know, the New York Times is going to exist, of course, but like, what condition will political journalism be in? What laws might they have passed? What might be against the law if there's Trump in a Republican Congress that reporters are free to do now? These aren't idle questions. These aren't abstract questions. These are real questions. And I wish to God the powerful mainstream media took this more seriously.
I wish to God they did as well. It's why I'm so glad not only to have the opportunity to talk to you and share this with our listeners, but why I'm so glad that you have this platform with the New Republic. And on a regular basis, on an everyday basis, are raising these issues in the way that they need to be raised, whether it's with this article in question or with each of the articles that you do. So, in times like these, when it's hard to come by the right kind of news and analysis, you need outlets like the New Republic. You need analysis like you do at the journal Democracy. And you need editors like Mike Tomasky. So I'm grateful you're there. I look forward to continuing conversations like this one. And I want to thank you for joining us today.
Thank you, David. Great chat.
And we'll be back, you know, tomorrow and every day with plenty of podcasts. And you know, we didn't take a break in this one and say this is, you know, just for members and, you know, as we often do, sort of put a paywall in the middle. It's because I thought this was important enough that you need to hear the whole thing. But if you want to be a member, go to the dsrnetwork.com. Click on membership. It's $5 a month, and we appreciate it. For now, bye-bye.